in the Old Testament, in the first book of Samuel, Samuel chapter 26. The first book of Samuel, chapter 26, in which we read of the second occasion on which David spared Saul, his enemy's life. The Ziphites went to Saul at Gibeah and said, "Is not David hiding on the hill of Hakilah, which faces Jeshimon?" So Saul went down to the desert of Ziph with his 3,000 chosen men of Israel to search there for David. That was with a view to destroying him if he could. Saul made his camp beside the road on the hill of Hakilah facing Jeshimon, but David stayed in the desert. When he saw that Saul had followed him there, he sent out scouts and learned that Saul had definitely arrived. Then David set out and went to the place where Saul had camped. He saw where Saul and Abner, son of Ner, the commander of the army, had lain down. Saul was lying inside the camp with the army encamped around him. David then asked Ahimelech the Hittite, that's not the Ahimelech, the priest of Israel, another man. David then asked Ahimelech the Hittite and Abishai, son of Zeruiah. Zeruiah was David's sister. You never hear, scarcely ever hear about Zeruiah after there was trouble up there in the north when Jacob returned to Canaan. Abishai then, who was of course David's nephew, son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, "Who will go down into the camp with me to Saul?" "I'll go with you," said Abishai. No word of Ahimelech. So David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there was Saul lying asleep inside the camp with his spear stuck in the ground near his head. Abner and the soldiers were lying round him. Abishai said to David, "Today God has given your enemy into your hands. Now let me pin him to the ground with one thrust of my spear. I won't strike him twice." But David said to Abishai, "Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? As surely as the Lord lives," he said. And here David is obeying the command that we have in the book of Deuteronomy, which says, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay." Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? As surely as the Lord lives, he said, "The Lord himself will strike him. Either his time will come and he will die, or he will go into battle and perish," which of course happened. "But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. Now," he said to Abishai, "get the spear and water jug that are near his head, and let's go." So David took the spear and water jug near Saul's head, and they left. No one saw or knew about it, nor did anyone wake up. Notice why. They were all sleeping because the Lord had put them into a deep sleep. Isn't that wonderful? Then David crossed over to the other side and stood on top of the hill some distance away. There was a wide space between them. He called out to the army and to Abner, son of Ner, "Aren't you going to answer me, Abner?" Abner replied, Who are you who calls to the king? David said, You're a man, aren't you? And who is like you in Israel? Why didn't you guard your lord, the king? Someone came to destroy your lord, the king. What have you done? What you have done is not good. As surely as the Lord lives, you and your men deserve to die because you did not guard your master, the Lord's anointed. Look around you. Where are the king's spear and water jug that were near his head? Saul himself recognized David's voice and said pathetically, Is that your voice, David, my son? And David replied, Yes, it is, my lord, the king. And he added, Why is my lord pursuing his servant? What have I done, and what wrong am I guilty of? Now let my lord the king listen to his servant's words. If the Lord has incited you against me, then may he accept an offering. If, however, men have done it, may they be cursed before the Lord. They have now driven me from my share in the Lord's inheritance and have practically said, Go serve other gods. Now, do not let my blood fall to the ground far from the presence of the Lord. The king of Israel has come out to look for a flea, as one hunts a partridge in the mountains. Then Saul said, I have sinned. Come back, David, my son, because you considered my life precious. Today I will not try to harm you again. Surely I have acted like a fool and have erred greatly. Here is the king's spear, David answered. Let one of your young men come over and get it. The Lord rewards every man. Notice this sentence. The Lord rewards every man for his righteousness and faithfulness. The Lord gave you into my hands today. Because David was righteous. Wonderful statement. The Lord gave you into my hands today, but I would not lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. As surely as I valued your life today. Notice the next part. He's not asking anything from this man. He does not trust this man for a moment. As surely as I valued your life today, so may the Lord value my life and deliver me from all trouble. Then Saul said to David, May you be blessed, my son David. You will do great things and surely triumph. So David went his way, on his way, and Saul returned home. Amen, may God. Let's read another verse. So I'll refer to it later on. Now see, after the triumph of grace in David's life, see how soon deep depression came upon him. This is one of the most astonishing verses in the Old Testament. But David thought to himself, One of these days I shall be destroyed by the hand of Saul. You know who gave him that thought? The devil himself. The best thing I can do is to escape to the land of who? The Philistines. Then Saul will give up searching for me anywhere in Israel, and I will slip out of his hand. Amen. May God bless to us his most holy word. The Old Testament, the first book of Samuel, chapter 26. Someone asked after last Sunday morning's sermon, was David wrong in wanting to slay Nabal and his men because he refused them help? And the answer is an unqualified yes, he was wrong. And it was only the grace of Abigail that saved him from a slaughter which really went against his own grain when he was himself and would have dogged him all his life, as later the sin with Bathsheba dogged his latter day. Of course, Nabal was different from Saul, but both needed mercy in the hope that they would repent, which is surely a mouthful. Here we have David in chapter 26 showing mercy again to poor Saul and sparing him a second time, which simply shows what a pathetic soul Saul had become. But because of his obsessive determination to destroy David, he was ripe, as we shall see in due course, he was ripe for summary judgment, and it came to him just as David prophesied. But if ever a man in straits from his enemy sought to leave him to the vengeance of God, Deuteronomy 32 and 35, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay. If ever a man in straits from his enemy sought to leave him to the vengeance of God, it was David. But we have in this chapter such an exciting human story that you almost forget what an act of sheer mercy it was on David's part to save Saul a second time. Here's a man who regarded all human relationships as subject to his healthy fear of God. It is always what God says that goes with David, nothing else. And should he temporarily lapse from that into carnal vindictiveness, as when he wanted to slay Nabal, in the matter of churlish Nabal, you remember, the Lord acknowledged the merciful trend of David's mind and heart. And so when David purposed to slay Nabal and all his men, the Lord sent Abigail. And graciously Abigail interposed, as we read, to save David from making the disastrous mistake of as Abigail said, shedding innocent blood, the blood of Nabal's men. But these horrid Ziphites were at it again. You see, searching for David because they wanted him destroyed. They were on Saul's side, as were the Keilahites. David, however, is such a masterly tactician that he is always one step ahead. And so far from Saul coming upon David, as nearly happened in chapter 24, it was David who came upon Saul and his men asleep here. and in a sleep which owed everything to the power of God. And God can do anything which benefits his own people. We shouldn't underestimate him. Today, he can do the same and greater than he did in those days when it suits him. It's next year it will be remembering Dunkirk and the smoothness of the English Channel at that time, which saved so many of our men, including one of our own loved ones. But what a holy adventurer David is. I'm sure he loved this when he came upon Saul and his men sleeping. And just as in the earlier encounter with Saul in the cave, you remember, when he had the pleasure of holding up the rag cut from Saul's robe and saying teasingly to him, "Who's the owner of this?" So now, I believe David's whole soul thrilled at the prospect of another encounter with Saul, now lying asleep in the valley. What fun he was going to have with him. So David challenged two, presumably of his bravest men, one of them his own nephew, the son of David's sister Zeruiah, Abishai by name. And he responded to David. He would go down with David to encounter the sleeping Saul. So under cover of the night, down they went to find Saul asleep with his spear stuck in the ground at his head, surrounded by all his sleeping warriors. Like a church that has got out of the Lord's will and the Lord puts her to sleep. I was thrilled. "Let me pin him to the ground with my sword," he said to David. "I won't need a second try." "No," said David. "He's the Lord's anointed. For even Saul, as a has-been, you see, as far as David was concerned, was still revered for his divine calling." Which is an interesting point as far as mercy for wrongdoers is concerned. Are you learning that from this chapter this morning? You remember the sad story of the local town official who, greatly to the dismay of many, was given a huge golden handshake of a pension despite his misdemeanors. Now you may not agree with that and the reasons anent it, but does it not come a little within distance of the mercy we have here? Do we not like mercy to others, although we would like it to ourselves? Oh, we've got to watch our thoughts here. And it's quite clear, you see, that what David said to Abishai then was nothing less than the pure, distilled essence of heaven. For consider God's attitude to persistently wicked men. Judas, for instance. David said to Abishai, "Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" Now, David would not have said that about Nabal. It was Abigail who went the second mile as far as he was concerned. But David went on. "As surely, Abishai, as the Lord lives, God himself will strike him. Either his time will come and he will die, or he will go into battle and perish," which is exactly what happened to Saul. It was the latter that overtook him, as we know, and shall see in subsequent chapters. if we go on to 2 Samuel. But see the consummate wisdom of David. The Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. So Abishai, take his spear and his water bottle and let us go. And the fact that they did it with complete immunity and impunity shows that as in the sleep, so now later on, the hand of God was in the whole operation. He is controlling it from heaven. What a thrill it is, isn't it, to be engaged in divine operations? What a thrill. You know, they may not all be as spectacular as this, but surely, as the servants of the living God, this sort of thing should happen to us all the time when we are engaging the enemy in a significant way. Is this not happening now in the world, in your world? Mercy and grace prevailing against vindictiveness? I think it is, because I am so conscious of engaging the enemy every time I minister, every time. And while it would be so easy to keep blistering offenders, say, in the matter of attendance at the prayer meeting, that is not the Lord's way to nag people. Why, you know, one man here resisted all appeals to attend prayer for more than 30 years before the Lord dealt him a devastating blow. And while all our hearts went out to him in his subsequent grief, the discerning had a hunch. You know, the Lord seldom says, this is for that. Very seldom, even in the Bible. The discerning had a hunch that the Lord had spoken in judgment. So David put a distance between the sleeping Saul and himself, and from the top of the hill shouted to wake him and his commander Abner. And you know, no sermonizing could do justice to the drama of this situation like the text itself. Verses 14 to 16 is one of the most histrionic, theatrical passages you ever read. What a piece of theater these verses would make. Let me read them to you again. Verse 14 of our chapter. He called out to the army and to Abner, son of Ner, aren't you going to answer me, Abner? Abner replied, who are you who calls the king? David said, you're a man, aren't you? And who is like you in Israel? Why didn't you guard your lord the king? Someone came to destroy your lord the king. What you have done is not good. As surely as the Lord lives, you and your men deserve to die, because you did not guard your master, the Lord's anointed. The sarcasm is profound. Look around you. Where are the king's spear and water jug that were near his head? And you see, it was Saul himself who answered, not Abner. He knew that voice. And waking up from his God-induced sleep and realizing that he had been overtaken once more by his enemy and was in a very vulnerable position, as the enemies of the Lord can easily be, Saul reverted to his pathetic, childish self and whimpered his reply. "Is that your voice, David, my son?" "Yes, it is, my lord, the king," said David, surely with at least some sarcastic emphasis on the words. "My lord, the king, this pathetic soul, the king of Israel." Then David repeated what he had said last time. "Why do you do this, Saul?" Which simply, of course, put the poor man absolutely in the wrong. He had no option but to eat very humble pie. And he needed to, for David spoke most trenchant words. Look at the words of 18 to 20. "Why is my Lord pursuing his servant? What have I done? What wrong am I guilty of? Now let my Lord the king listen to his servant's words. If the Lord has incited you against me, then may he accept an offering. If, however, men have done it, may they be cursed before the Lord. They have now driven me from my share in the Lord's inheritance and have said, 'Go serve other gods, away to the Philistines.' Now," he says, "do not let my blood fall to the ground far from the presence of the Lord. The king of Israel has come out to look for a flea, as one hunts a partridge in the mountains." And you see, we have the same infinitely pathetic response as formerly at verse 21. "Then Saul said, 'I have sinned. Come back, David, my son. Because you considered my life precious today, I will not try to harm you again. Surely I have acted like a fool and have erred greatly.'" David apparently made no reply to that. Saul's words in his mind were utterly worthless. The mere whimpering of a spoilt child who has been whipped and turns all soft and flabby. You take no notice of anything that such a soul says in its tragic self-exposure. So David quite ignored his words. But see how practical David is. "Here's your spear, Saul. Let someone come and get it." And then David uttered a word which showed how deeply he understood the ways of his God. "The Lord rewards a man for his righteousness and faithfulness." Now he was speaking there of himself. The Lord had protected David because he sought to do the right and was faithful to God and merciful to his enemy. I think that's wonderful. And you see, that righteousness and faithfulness is that which is true to a man's God, not only in respect of doing right, but in showing mercy. You see, righteousness and mercy kiss each other. The Psalms is something like that, doesn't it? And that's what Jesus drew forth from the expert in the law, you remember, when he asked him concerning which of the three passers-by was neighbor to the man in trouble. You remember the Good Samaritan? Which of the three passers-by was neighbor to the man in trouble? And he replied, "He who showed mercy." And here's the marvelous thing, that it is those who are righteous by faith and therefore partake of God's righteousness who are merciful. simply because there is a deep, it may be a subterranean connection, a deep connection, in fact, a deep identity between right and good, and between right and mercy. You see that? The Lord gave you into my hands today, said David to Saul, but I would not lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. As surely as I value your life today. Notice what David does not say, because he puts absolutely no trust in this poor man. As I value your life today, he puts himself in the Lord's hands. He would never trust Saul again. So he says, may the Lord value my life and deliver me from trouble. You see, the transaction is not directly between David and Saul, but between David and Saul via the Lord. The Lord's in this, you see. And it is that which makes proper relationships between people. Any people. It's that which makes a happy marriage. And it's that which makes for concord and harmony and sweet relationships between any people who know the Lord, that we see ourselves as in the Lord's presence, and He always between us, always the Lord between us. What is it that I sometimes say to married couples at their wedding? See that the Lord is always between you. Let no one else come between you. Never let anyone else come between you. But see that the Lord is always between you, because He will bring you closer together than you could ever be without Him. No doubt about that. Where did I find my place? Yes, he would never trust Saul again. And it is that, I'm saying, which makes for proper relationships between people. And all that Saul could do in the situation was to mouth, possibly by now quite sincerely, to mouth a blessing on David, acknowledging that he would yet triumph and do great things. Well, that was obvious. The Lord having been with him these two remarkable times. So they parted, David being singularly blessed. But you know, if we read, as we did at the reading, one verse further on into chapter 27, we get the shock of our lives. At the very peak of David's fugitive triumph, what do you think happens? A spirit of the completest defeatism, depression, takes over. And he does one of the most disastrous things of his young career. In complete and utter depression, he gives himself into the hands of the Philistines to get away from Saul. He says, I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. Oh, David, perish that thought, not you. The best I can do, says he, how deep a depression has fallen upon this man for him to say this. After that, the best I can do is to escape into the hands of the Philistines. Now, next week I want to try and show how this youthful lapse of David's forms subterranean links with what happened to David in the sin of his maturity. But today, all that is necessary is to show how fickle even the most dedicated human nature can be in times of stress. And happy is the person who puts his whole trust in another human being, or even in himself, without prior and superior trust in God. We are only servants. James Patterson was showing us on Wednesday evening at Bible study that while Paul planted and Apollos watered, it was God who gave the increase. And the safest blessings are those which come from the heart of God himself. Here was David in what you could only call the peak of spiritual condition, when he so perfectly established connection between righteousness and the mercy of good deeds. And so soon after that, the very next verse, he is in the depth of despair. Now, you would never expect to have a reference to the enemy of God and man in this context. You simply don't find the devil mentioned here at all. But was he ever as plainly at work as in what he did to David in chapter 27, verse 1? Eh? I recall that after I had given my first address on the devil at Swanwick many, many years ago, the series is found on the bookstall under the title The Biblical Teaching of the Devil. After that first address, in the evening at Swanwick, the whole company reviewed the work of the day. And one of the other speakers, a young Anglican, who incidentally later in the conference came and confessed to me about his disordered life, said that evening that I had read the devil into the Old Testament all over the place where he wasn't even mentioned. Now, I remember that an older speaker came to my defense. But what I said in reply was simply this: where do you not find traces of his working throughout both Testaments? Where do you not see his dirty paws? He is everywhere, and he is certainly here doing despot to a servant of God, David, at the very peak of his godly achievement. I wonder if David went away from that second encounter with Saul rejoicing at God's goodness to him, and then permitting himself a pat on the back, as if to say, what a good boy am I. Now, if I'm right, Satan was already there, and he was soon to turn David's glorious triumph into dust and ashes by reminding him that because you couldn't trust a word that sick Saul said, the pursuit was far from over, and next time it might not be as former times. He might find himself fatally in the hands of relentless Saul. How else can you explain chapter 27, verse 1? That amazing verse. I must say that when I first came across it many years ago, it absolutely astonished me and led me to a long series on David by which one ultimately established a somewhat plausible satanic connection between this lapse of David's youth and the ruinous sin of his old age with Bathsheba, and which, of course, taught me much about the wiles of the devil. You see, it is this what I call subterranean connection, like the underwater cables which first established telephonic communication between America and here before radio. This subterranean connection, which connects the fruit of long forgotten and forgiven sins with later lapses. Notice what I'm saying. Subterranean connection, which connects the fruit of long forgotten and forgiven sins with later lapses. In this case, David's major sin of his youth, his amazing desertion to the Philistines for fear of Saul, and during that lapse, taking Maacah, the Bedouin chieftain's daughter, and begetting Absalom by her. Connecting that with the major sin of his old age, when he committed adultery with Bathsheba and procured the murder of her husband, the faithful Uriah, upon which the same Absalom, who never should have been, now grown up and grown proud as the favorite son of David, rose against his father and unseated him temporarily from his throne. Now, do you see what I'm saying? I hope it's not too complex. That the fruit of the earlier sin, not the sin, but the fruit of that earlier sin, namely Absalom, whom David unwisely doted on, was kept under wraps while David behaved himself. But as soon as the complacent old man sinned significantly with Bathsheba, the fruit of the earlier sin reactivated. And lo and behold, who should rise to embarrass David after his adulterous association with that woman but his favorite son Absalom, whom he trusted too much and who drove him from his throne. And if my reasoning is right, then to keep the remaining fruit of earlier sins long since forgiven under the blood and safe from Satan's machinations, we need to continue to walk worthy of the Lord so that no lapse reactivates. What shall I call them? That no lapse reactivates the smoldering embers of ancient fires, ancient conflagrations. Absalom, who should never have been, became the humbler of his father David, who was to take flight from his own son, all because of David's moment of illicit pleasure with another man's wife. Be sure your sin will find you out, whatever out may mean. There is only safety, not to speak of certainty and enjoyment, but there is only safety in holy living. No safety out of that at all. God, help us to keep to the paths of his righteousness and mercy, so that we may be blessed. Very few of the Old Testament saints, prophets, patriarchs, ended their days well. Jeremiah, an exception, I should think. God, keep us righteous and merciful, that we may be blessed to the end of our days, and then enter into that reward that he has.